keep this frequency clear.
But guess what? You don't get to tell me when I can stop speaking. Well,
tune in to Queering the Air.
Report on trans and intersex issues with accuracy, dignity, and respect.
Podcast edition, and therefore, sorry, no music.
Change the narrative rather than combat the narrative.
I know who I am. Took me 20 years to get here. I'm not going to let some idiot senator destroy that.
3CR Community Radio.
Our stories are best told when we are the ones telling them. It helps combat the perpetuation of stereotypes, misinformation, and lies.
I discovered in the face of overwhelming prejudice and persecution an incredible strength through being fiercely fabulous.
Welcome to Queering the Air, Sundays from 3 to 4 on 3CR. 3CR is proud to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which we transmit people-powered radio. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
Welcome one, welcome all. This is Madison Moffat. My pronouns are she and her, and welcome to Queering the Air. And before we start, as we like to do so, I want to start with a particular message that assists people to understand how best to support programs like Queering the Air and others on 3CR.
ReCR is radical radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Yes, and shows like Queering the Air and indeed the entire stable of fabulous broadcasting brought to you by 3CR relies heavily on the financial support and solidarity of its listeners. So please do subscribe if you have not done so already. And of course, for those who have, thank you very much.
Meow 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 meow.
Meow. Yes, so it's our regular segment that as of late we've decided to call meow 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 meow. And today we're going to focus on a number of events over the course of the next few weeks. So, where you can be asked to take the plunge for pride. Now, what does that mean? Well, fearless descents to fearless futures are asking you whether you are bold enough to go over the edge for a cause that matters. And more specifically, this would be your chance to abseil both inside and outside the iconic five-storey Victorian Pride Centre in St Kilda, and in doing so, raise funds that help this vital community hub to thrive vibrantly and proudly. So whether you're conquering fears or just there for the thrill, every descent supports the Victorian Pride Centre's ongoing work to empower LGBTIQA+ communities across Victoria. So this will be led by expert instructors from the Climbing Company. So this professionally run event is safe, unforgettable, and open to all experience levels. Now, tickets are $250 for the double descent experience. So, not exactly cheap, but then again, you've got to make sure these things are done properly. So I think that's probably part of the cost. So what's on offer? We'll take the plunge for Pride souvenirs and to remember your rooftop hero moment. Munro's bar is open on the rooftop for post-climb cheers. There'll be a free sausage sizzle for all triumphant abseilers. I'm sure those who weren't so triumphant will also get a sausage. And there'll be all-day DJing, bringing the sleigh and the soundtrack to your descent. So that's being held at the Victorian Pride Centre. And I just realised I didn't include what time that is. So I will quickly look it up. There we go. So it starts on Saturday, the 24th of May at 9 p.m. So there. Okay. Now the Queer Multicultural Festival will be on at the June the 7th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and it'll be held at the Victorian Pride Centre. And it'll be a celebration of culture, creativity and community. So join them for a vibrant celebration of LGBTIQA plus voices, art and storytelling from diverse cultural backgrounds. So this event will bring together emerging and established queer creatives, blending music, fashion, spoken word and performance in a spectacular showcase of talent and resilience. So what to expect? Well, live performances by queer musicians, poets and storytellers, interactive art installations and creative workshops. So, you know, as a result, you don't merely have to observe others being creative. You can be part of a workshop and learn a creative school of your own. Also, engaging panel discussions on identity, intersectionality and creative leadership. So this free event is part of the Pride Month at Victorian Pride Centre and is presented as part of the Rise in Pride initiative, which is a groundbreaking program supporting LGBTIQA plus creatives across multiple disciplines. So again, that's Saturday on June the 7th. So do book, because although it is free, registration is required. And tickets can be found at the Victorian Pride Centre website. Now, there's going to be an Ida Hobbit morning tea. So Ida Hobbit, that is the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, Interphobia and Transphobia. And there's an event, a morning tea event, that again is going to be held by the Victorian Pride Centre, and it's free. So that will be held on Wednesday, the 15th of May at 10:30. So they're asking you to join them for a heartwarming morning tea to celebrate Ida Hobbit. This is a day to stand together in solidarity, raise awareness and celebrate our vibrant LGBTIQ plus communities. So enjoy a cuppa, some sweet treats and some good company in a welcoming space that champions inclusion, pride and connection. Now, whether you're a regular visitor or if it's your first time at the Pride Centre, everyone is welcome. It's free to attend, but again, an RSVP is required. And just come as you are. So again, that's at the Vic Pride Centre, Ida Hobbit Morning Tea on Wednesday, the 15th of May, starting at 10:30 a.m. Now, Mr. Vic Bears is having for 2025 a T-shirt fundraiser. They're asking us to join them for an all-gender event at Grouse Melbourne for the launch of Mr. Vic Bear's 2025 limited edition T-shirt line and fundraising initiative. So you can purchase a T-shirt on the day, enjoy drinks and specials and great tunes, watch killer drag performances and catch up with mates. Billy Mather, our current reigning Sush Bear, has teamed up with Sugar Plum Fairy to release a limited edition range of T-shirts. And funds raised from this initiative will be donated to the Australian Queer Archives, who have been collecting, preserving and celebrating Australia's very queer history since 1978. So again, held by the Vic Bears, it's being held at... What is wrong with me today? Do you think? Oh, at Grouse Melbourne. But what on earth is the date? Good Lord. People think that they're prepared. And the date for that is Saturday, the 10th of May at 3 p.m. Anyway, so That was
meow 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 meow
meow meow meow meow meow meow meow meow meow
meow. Yes, meow, and meow at me for not being quite prepared, but that's okay, I got there in the end. Queer Histories and Queer Futures is an audio journey into the stories of our LGBTQIA+ communities in Merribeck, past, present and future. From pubs to squats, protests to parties, it outlines Merribeck's queer history as told by the people who shaped the collective histories of LGBTIQIA+ organising, activism and community in Merribeck and our imaginings for the future. So, it's a Lee Ellis Working Group initiative of Merribeck Libraries and produced for Merribeck City Council by the 3CR Community Radio. And it's available as a podcast on the 3CR website. So that's Queer Histories, Queer Futures, available on the 3CR website. Today we're going to focus a bit on one particular episode of Queer Histories, Queer Futures for a while, and it's by Sam Elkin, trans male, who is quite well known also on radio, as it turns out. They, you know, loathe to promote other radio stations, but on the other hand, not loathe to promote Sam Elkin, who does appear on Queer View Mirror on Triple R. But today we're going to listen to Sam talk about the history of the Orlando Club, which is essentially was a queer nightclub event that had its beginnings, had its heyday, and had its twilight. And Sam covers it all.
On this episode of Queer Histories, Queer Futures, our guest is Sam Elkin, talking about Orlando.
Yes, so Orlando Queer Indie Disco started back in 2009. I've checked the dates and I'm pretty sure the first one was on Friday the 26th of June 2009, as far as I can recall. The origin of it really was my friend Steph Price and I were living on Talbot Street in Brunswick, and we lived right near the Victoria Hotel, which is 380 Victoria Street in Brunswick. And when we were living there, it was like pre-reno. It was kind of an old shitty bar that not that many people were going to. Like, obviously there were old regulars and stuff, but it just seemed like such a huge pub had this like magical checkered dance floor. The pub was either painted pink or green. It was some like really sort of like fluoro color that was not in fashion at the time. And Steph and I just thought, God, this would be such a cool place to have an event. Like, this is such an underutilized space. So that's how the original idea for Orlando came about. When we had our first event, like, I remember how we organized it. It was sort of like in the pre-Facebook era. Like, I might have had a Facebook then, but it wasn't necessarily something that you organized around at the time. So we just printed out like literally thousands of posters and posted all around Brunswick and Coburg and the whole of the Inner North to promote the event. Like, it was the most heavily promoted event in human history. And yeah, there were a bunch of us, sort of six of my close friends, who were helping to organize the first one. And we had no idea how many people were going to turn up. We were like, you know, it could be three, could be 300, like, because there was no RSVP process, because it was like a pre-internet event in a sense. And yeah, so when we had the first event, and like, it must have been, you know, 250 or something people came through the door, like, we were totally blown away. Like, there was clearly an appetite for a big queer party in Brunswick, which is what we thought, but we didn't know. So it was amazing. We described it. I've got the way that we originally described the event, so I'll read it out to you, because this definitely sums it up. We play indie, electro, post-punk, hip-hop on a giant checkered dance floor, so there's plenty of room for you to bang out your best moves or shuffle around awkwardly. If you're looking for a spot to chat the night away, there is plenty of room in the generously sized beer garden. Be prepared for rad costumes, questionable toilet art, unprofessional DJs, and amateur door staff. Orlando is a strictly not-for-profit event. All proceeds go to good causes. We're here to have fun, not make money. A childcare subsidy is available on request. So, in terms of the performers, for the most part, it was us just like DJing on a laptop. So there weren't any sort of like professional DJs. It was definitely not a professional outfit. But because there were so many of us involved, I checked at our peak. We had 9 people involved in like the Orlando Collective. And we had this bizarre and unwieldy way of choosing the songs where we would sit around on a Sunday afternoon, have beers in somebody's backyard, and everybody would get a chance to choose like, say 10 songs or something like that, but it would have to go through committee, and if anybody didn't like the song they could veto it. It was so dumb. So like there was this constant tension, there was like a battle of wills between one side of the collective that was more into playing, you know, pop songs like George Michael or Whitney Houston or whatever, and then there was the sort of post-punk new wave kind of edge that wanted to kind of educate the people of Brunswick about like cool music and stuff like that. And I was probably in the middle, like trying to be a peacemaker as always. And so the hard edges always got vetoed out, and we ended up somehow in the middle, which was a weird way of doing things. We were really interested in trying to bring members of the community out that might not necessarily feel safe or might not sort of have time or the money to go out. So one thing that was really important to us was doing the childcare or carer subsidy. Not that many people took us up on it in the whole time we had it. It would have been sort of half a dozen, maybe 10 at max. But like having the ability, I think we would give like $50 or something like that, which feels like nothing now. But, you know, it was something so that people could like organize a babysitter or for a friend to come around and order a couple of pizzas so that their loved ones could be cared for and that they could come out. We loved that. We felt like it was a really important kind of feminist act to be like, come out, we want you here, you know, like we want to include you in the party. Yeah, it was still pretty seedy in places, like not in a bad way. I loved it. We lived around the corner and I loved living around there. We could afford to live around there, whereas I wouldn't be able to afford to live around there now, I'm pretty sure. You know, we lived in a unrenovated shithole rental. I think we lived next door to like a glass factory or something like that. So I'm sure that took years off my life living there because of all the dust. So everything was very dusty. But yeah, it was still sort of like a light industrial area. And, you know, there were coffee shops around. Like, I'm not saying it was a cultural wasteland or anything like that. It felt like a really lively, cool place to be, but it was pretty rough around the edges. It wasn't shiny in the way that everything feels like it's had a very specific reno, and everything kind of is wood paneled now in a very kind of like specific way that feels unique to this era. It was definitely like loud and cheerful, and you know, the queer community, the kind of more alternative part of the queer community, like students or maybe like more master's students, like, you know, people that were sort of a bit older and maybe were working and studying, tended to live out the back end of Brunswick or Coburg. And yeah, it definitely had a kind of like very queer feel, but it was also a very, obviously, and it remains a very multicultural area where heaps of, you know, Arab people, people from the Middle East, Lebanese community, you know, it was a real sort of hotbed of great food, great culture. And you'd have, you know, the old nonnas and the nonnos living around. So yeah, there was often an interesting mix where you'd have a share house of like rat bag, you know, uni students with weird hair and piercings. And then you'd have a, you know, 85-year-old nonna who's like hosing down the road, and then you would have, you know, a multi-generational kind of Arab family or something like that. So it was a, you know, it was a cool place to be that felt like a genuinely what you wanted the world to be like. And for me, it was huge because that's not what Perth was like for me. It was like a horrific monoculture. So I loved living in Brunswick at that time. It was kind of edgy, and actually there was a bit of a dark side to that, which I wanted to talk about, which was that there was another queer night that was just down the road from where Orlando was. The night was called Bambi Bent and Ambiguous, and it was at, I think the pub was called the Railway Hotel at the time, but it's whatever that giant pub is that's next to the big Woolworths on Albert Street. So it was really our like non-binary brother, sister event. And I think it happened on like a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. Everybody who was involved in that night were like hospo kids. So it was whenever hospo weekend was on, they had the earlier part of the week where it's, we were all kind of like sad office workers. So their night, Bambi Bent in Ambiguous, was always pretty wild. And they had a really horrible situation where one of their punters was walking home, I believe like sort of down Victoria Street and into the park lands to go home. And she got beaten up by a bunch of people. And it was, you know, seemed like a homophobic attack from as far as we could tell. It was a horrific thing that had happened. And we ended up having a kind of community organizing meeting at the Victoria Hotel to discuss how to respond to queerphobic violence that was happening at that time. And we got, you know, a bunch of accounts from people who were saying that, you know, they'd come to Orlando and sort of got, you know, if not attacked, then at least sort of screamed at and verbally harassed, you know, at the ATM or around the venue and things like that. So a bunch of people started raising real security concerns that they had that were sort of homophobic or queerphobic in nature. And yeah, it was a really tough one to deal with because we were, you know, radical anti-cop kind of abolitionist type people. We didn't want the police to be at our event, but we also wanted people to be safe. So the Anti-Violence Project got involved, who used to be run by Greg Atkins. I don't know if it's still around, but I remember Greg was involved, and we ended up putting out a bunch of flyers that we handed out at events being like, make sure you know, stay safe. Here's some practical tips on staying safe, like tell a friend if you're leaving, try and walk home with somebody else, you know, make sure you have somebody's number in your phone, you know, hold keys, like things like that. And I think we had a whole bunch of like paraphernalia around the venue of like queers bash back and, you know, sort of calling out to that sort of more radical part of our history. So, but yeah, it was a really thorny issue for us to deal with. And the Brunswick police station was just around the corner from the Vic, and we didn't necessarily have the best relationship with the police. So it was awkward when we had to deal with this issue. There were gay and lesbian liaison officers at the time, GLOs as they were called. A couple of them came down. So we had an organising event about it in a midweek to kind of discuss it. And the folks from Bambi Bent in Ambiguous came down. Greg from the Anti-Violence Project came down, and the GLOs from the Brunswick Police Station or wherever they came from came down. And, you know, as is often the case when you're kind of interacting with the police, like the people that you deal with who have self kind of like opted in to be a GLO officer, they're not usually difficult or horrible to deal with. Like they want things to be good. They want the world to be a certain way. It's just that when they're not there, you're dealing with some, you know, horrible person at the police station who's going to be awful to you. So while they gave some reassurance to some, I'm sure, like I didn't necessarily think that everybody at the Brunswick Police Station was going to be, you know, open to following up, you know, a queer attack with the same level of respect and dignity that they might for, you know, a heterosexual woman or whatever it might be who had been out that night. Yeah, it was a really, really tricky situation. I remember there were, yeah, toilets up in those parks that were periodically closed down by the police, and there were signs saying like, you know, due to antisocial behaviour, we've closed these toilets. And, you know, it was so obviously a kind of anti-beat kind of like reaction. So yeah, we really didn't want to call on the police. We really didn't want the police or security guards even at our events. We were really down on the idea of having security guards. I feel like you have security guards everything now and it's just a thing, but we didn't want that. We didn't have that. There was none of that at our events, and we were fine. Like, well, sort of, except for this thing that happened, which was awful. And it did seem that they were targeting queer people, like it was, you know, bored young people who, I don't know, lived in the area or travelled to kind of attack queer people. I think it was a little bit of a kind of cultural battlefield at that time about like whose place this was and whose values should rule the roost. And it was, yeah, pretty scary at times. And it was really upsetting when, you know, we actually asked people for their experiences. So, you know, we put messages out on Facebook being like, have you, you know, been attacked or yelled at, or have you felt threatened, like coming to one of our events? And we had a bunch of people come back say yes. And that was, yeah, really upsetting to hear, because, you know, we all came in at like 7 p.m. to sort of set up and tended to leave in a group. So we weren't having those experiences. So while it was hard to hear, yeah, it was important to talk about. We had a total of 14 events that occurred at the Victoria Hotel in Brunswick. So that was really what I consider it to be, like the glory days of it. But it really depends on which era of Orlando you were, you know, involved with. So yeah, that went on until I think the end of 2010, at which point the owners changed. So the place got a reno and it was going for a bit of a different look and feel, and it wasn't the sort of seedy indie disco kind of crappy vibes anymore. And so we basically got kicked out, which was a bummer. Also, you know, I think they felt quite rightly that our clientele were a little bit loose for the kind of vibe that they were going for. So we lost our home at the Victoria Hotel and started looking around for a new venue. And we ended up at the Edinburgh Castle, which is further down the road in Brunswick on Sydney Road. And we had three there. And then we had a New Year's party at a £1,000 Bend, a venue that sadly closed in the city. It's on Little Lonsdale Street. It was this huge venue. And I, you know, I was just looking it up this morning. We sold 750 tickets for that. So it was like a big event, you know. It was our real jewel in the crown kind of event. And yeah, that was a real highlight of Orlando. And then, yeah, from there we ended up at the Workers Club in Fitzroy because, yeah, we never really found a permanent home after the Victoria Hotel. The Victoria Hotel was very special to us. That dance floor, it was a huge checkered dance floor. It was just like so perfect. So, yeah, it did go for, I think, 3 years in total. We kind of like had little intermittent events up until 2012, but then people went in their different directions. Alex Etling, who was involved, he ended up doing Captain Moonlight, which is an event that went for years at the John Curtin Hotel in Carlton. Rachel Chalara ended up doing an event called Tomboy, which is a precursor of the current event that's called Tomboy. I think in the city somewhere, I don't know. I moved to Sydney and ended up running a couple of events under the title Butch Please. So we all kind of ended up continuing to do queer indie stuff, but in different places.
It's striking how, listening to that history, some of it you get a sense that maybe we have progressed in some small areas. But, you know, we're talking about 2009, I believe, Sam said, and so many of the challenges still exist. I mean, how many queer events have had to move around, you know, like vagrancies, rather than having, you know, their own solid club that they can rely upon month on month or quarter on quarter. It seems to still be the situation. And how many queer nights over the last couple of years have shut down? And that's not just due to COVID. And indeed, I thought I would play Sam Elkin's reflections in a different episode of Queer History's Queer Futures, where Sam reflects on the notion of queer futures and a queer utopia. And it seems that, you know, without wanting to put words in their mouth, they might agree with me about how things may not only just seem to be, some of our challenges are not only remaining, but some of them seem to be coming full circle all over again.
I wish I was an optimist and that we were heading towards queer utopia, but I am really concerned about the rise of the right, both in Australia, obviously in the United States and around the world. I think, you know, you just have to look to the US, seeing the, you know, rolling back of protection, you know, of equality provisions and things like that. You know, I feel like you could probably get up an asylum seeker claim for a trans person living in the United States or certain part of it now. Like, it's just not safe. There is a rollback going on around the world, and it's just a question of whether or not Australia will, you know, buck the trend and stay true with LGBTIQA plus rights, or whether we start losing ground. And I feel like we're in a real question mark time at the moment.
Indeed, well put. Brothers Ray and Dave Davies, who were the lead guitarist and the lead singer of his band The Kinks, were both bisexual. And using the parlance of the early 60s, that is why they decided to call themselves The Kinks. Now, this song hints of being asked repeatedly why they won't settle down, particularly one of the verses. The Kinks, I'm Not Like Everyone Else, from 1968.
As this is the podcast version, this music is not part of the recording.
A few weeks ago, we had Jackie Turner on the show, interviewed about a pledge that they had arranged for over 120, I think in the end it was closer to 200, candidates signed in order to assure that they will do whatever they can to protect trans rights. We didn't have quite time to play the entire interview, and today I want to play the remainder because I feel that now that the election is over, and thankfully a certain party is not going to get into government, and a certain shiny-headed person even seems like they're going to lose their seat. Oh, so sad, too bad. But now, I think, is the time to start thinking, what next? And perhaps, you know, to an extent, the conversation that I'm about to play that did not form part of the broadcast on the 20th of April might offer some possible insights to that. So this is Jackie Turner from the Trans Justice Project on coalition building.
People such as myself need to check their privilege, because I will often throw around the term TGDNB culture, or the term TGDNB community, and talk about that as if it's just one homogenous group. But as a matter of fact, of course, we're made up of intersectional groupings, some of which include people who are particularly marginalized, people who are particularly socially marginalized, economically marginalized. Examples that come to mind immediately are trans people of color, trans people who engage in sex work, and trans migrants. Mm. So I'm wondering what it is that you would have to say around the importance of, again, with coalition building, both including those people as part of that coalition and also making sure that, say, a broader popular front does not lose sight of the importance of protecting our most marginalized parts of our community.
Yeah, totally. And I think that this is one of the things that is really important about some of these commitments, is that, like, when we talk about making trans healthcare accessible and affordable to everyone who needs it, right? There are lots of trans people in prisons around the country who have a lot of trouble accessing gender-affirming care, like hormones. There's a bunch of barriers in place there. And then also, like, when we think about regional and remote communities, right? Like,
yes,
people don't necessarily have the luxury of being able to come into the city to go to a clinic. No. There's a bunch of barriers there that exist for people.
Yes.
And so I think it's really important that we're taking an approach where it's like, okay, how do we make this actually accessible for everyone? And how do we make it culturally appropriate for people as well, so that they can access services that they need and that they feel safe accessing? There's a bunch of working groups and stuff that are talking about this in detail, about how to really do this well in a way that services their community. But I think the thing here is about solidarity and about working with the people who are already doing this work and taking the lead on the things that are necessary from them as well. I think the other thing is actually being brave enough to step up and stand with other social justice movements, even when it might come at personal risk. And so thinking about how we show solidarity with the Movement for a Free Palestine and their demands for social justice. So, like, a thing that's been really important to us is supporting the movement. There's a number of LGBT organizations that haven't been able to, or have decided to stay silent in the face of the ongoing genocide. And we think that it's really important that we're outspoken about it and calling people to action and being a voice in the queer community who's actually calling attention to it and wanting people to take action and wanting people to get involved.
And it seems to me that initiatives of this kind are able to provide us over time with a distillation of exactly who our allies are. And then from there, we can test the intersectional nature of their alliance. So we can first establish who these people are. For instance, we've now established that more than 120 candidates are at least willing to sign our pledge. And then come May the 1st, particularly those who are voted in their seats, can then be tested by our community as to not just the strength of their pledge, but also the intersectional nature of it.
Yeah, for sure. What we've seen in past social movements that have been really powerful and really effective is that they give people steps along the way. So we can't necessarily always take someone from zero to 100, but we can give them steps along the way that make it safe for them to step forward and be a little bit braver, but also that help us towards our ultimate goal, right? And so, making sure that we're building that support and power so that we can actually change the political landscape that we're working in. We can shift the views of the public and we can shift the calculus that these politicians are working to that make them make the decisions that they make.
So the pledge can then be seen as the status of support at a base level. And then from there, we can work in, where necessary, help representatives to be braver and braver. And so therefore, in terms of their allyship, over time, we improve their effectiveness as a allying parliamentary member.
That's right, yeah.
Very important work, Jackie. Congratulations on the pledge and also on the level of response that you've received so far.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Trans Day of Visibility rally in Melbourne was on March the 31st, and 3CR was there to record the public conversation. Quinn was a trans person who spoke really effectively, I felt, giving reflections on the parallels between oppression of trans persons and of the Palestinian people and others more broadly. The struggles of transgender diverse and non-binary people match much that is experienced by the wider LGBTIQA+ community and the global community of humankind. So, I thought we'd play Quinn's just wonderful speech from that rally as part of the program, and here it is.
Quinn is a young trans artist, a student, and a Palestine advocate who lives on Wurundjeri land. He's experienced the Royal Children's Waitlist firsthand and brings us a message for our inept leaders. Quinn!
Good evening, everyone. My name is Quinn. I'm 16. I use he, him pronouns. I'm shitting bricks right now. I'm getting very emotional to see everyone here, but I'll get through it. But I have a lot of opinions. I have a lot of feelings. I've tried to cut it down for you all today, but thank you all. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge the owners of this land, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nations. In our community, I still see racism festering, and we need to abolish that, and we need to educate each other in our community to make sure everyone in the trans community is included. It is so important to take care of our Black brothers and sisters more than ever before. Sovereignty was never ceded, so this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. One time for the people across the street. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. As I said before, my name is Quinn, 16, also known as Quinn Victoria in the drag scene. I use he, him pronouns, and I have a range of titles from trans man, local drag queen, high school student, artist, Palestine advocate, but most importantly, human being. I'm saying that again, human being. As someone in both the trans community and the pro-Palestine community, a lot of us queer folk have faced quite a bit of backlash, especially online. Many queer and trans people have been met with a particular argument that LGBTQIA+ people supporting Palestinians is like chickens for KFC or minks for fur. That is wrong. Hey! LGBTQIA plus discrimination is not unique to Palestinian society. It exists in most parts of the world, including in Israeli society and in Australia, as I'm sure many of you know. It is not a near universal phenomenon. Homophobia, transphobia, sexism, gender, and sexuality-based violence is all realities that we have to grapple with in this world. It is wrong to label Palestinian society as uniquely transphobic, or to say that transphobia is a fundamental part of their culture without this broader context, as well as understanding the ways that life under brutal military occupation worsens homophobia and transphobia within Palestinian society. To understand how queer people are treated in Palestine, we need to look at the larger issue of how freedom is denied to all Palestinians. We cannot suggest that the fight against racism towards Palestinians should stop or be weakened just because there is homophobia in Palestinian society. Not only does it erase the existence of queer Palestinians who face both homophobic, transphobic and racial violence, it also overlooks the history of LGBTQIA plus activism in Palestinian communities. Transphobia is in both Palestinian society and Israeli culture. But Zionist airstrikes don't target queer people. They target food sources, they target hospitals, they target mosques, they target churches, they target innocent civilians, they target AIDS, they target children. They target anyone who will stand in their way of their goal, which is the destruction of Palestinians. Shame. Shame! I have empathy for the Palestinian people, for their family, for their culture. And I never knew up until now that it was so controversial to be against strategic ethnical cleansing. Shame.
Shame!
On a far much smaller and sneakier scale, this is what the Queensland government is trying to do to trans kids like me. Deny our existence and history and keep nonchalantly causing harm until we aren't around to call them out. Shame.
Shame!
I have known I'm trans since I was around 10, but I only started telling a few select people when I was around 12. On June 12, 2021, I spoke to my GP and I got on the RCH waitlist. They told me it can be 2 years. How stupid was I to think I could achieve an appointment in 2 years? I got on the waitlist June 2021. I got off the waitlist November 2024. Shame.
Yay!
Through these nearly 4 years, I went through a bit more than the average teen. I endured verbal abuse from adults, teachers, and peers alike in some words, including alien, freak, and the list goes on.
Yay!
I have had sticks and rocks being thrown at me for being trans at my school, which may I add was the far more diverse and supporting school I went to.
Hey!
I have had people in cars roll down their windows on my own street where I live to call me a tranny or to fetishize me, a 13-year-old trans boy.
Hey!
4 years without any checkups or contact or support. Praying every day I would get an email from the RCH saying I made it through. The worst part is it's not even the service itself. It's the government that is underfunding and understaffing this unbelievable crucial service.
Shame!
But I am one of the lucky ones. I'm one of the people who survived it. I'm fairly supportive parents. I have an incredible group of friends who love me. And I have an incredible community.
Love you,
but I have seen too many of our trans siblings leave us too soon to make it past the waitlist or to make it to 18. Surveys of Australian trans and non-binary youth show that 87% report they have experienced suicidal thoughts at some point in their lives. 79% have ever self-harmed, and 43% have ever attempted suicide. Do you think these numbers are reasonable or fair?
No!
No way. Because to me, these numbers show that the government is neglecting us, neglecting me. This decision to put a hold on gender-affirming care for trans youth in Queensland was made with zero consultation from medical specialists and zero input from communities who it affects.
Shame!
Here is my message for any politicians who are with this decision, and my message to Tim Nicholls. How dare you, sir? This decision is not going to protect kids like me. It can be the thing that kills them. So, get your pinkwashing cops out of our community spaces. Get your white chubby hands out of our clinic and off my body. And lastly, go f*** yourself, sir. As a community, have been through a lot this past year. Trans kids have felt more alone than ever, but all of you being here today, Jesus, that is a lot of people. But all of you being here today gives young people like me hope and joy and love that one day we can just be with everyone in this space and loved and be our true and authentic selves without being oppressed by out-of-touch politicians. I cannot describe how it feels to see so many allies come here after a long day of work to support us. Brothers, sisters, siblings, our existence is resistance, and we will continue fighting back. We will continue speaking up. We will continue to protest this oppressive behaviour until we reach full liberation for all trans people. Thank you very much.
And again, that was Quinn, pronouns he, him, speaking at the Trans Day of Visibility rally on March the 31st in Naarm, also known as Melbourne. So if that is the future for queer folk generally and for trans and gender diverse and non-binary people specifically, then we are in good hands, I would have to say. So on the 5th of April, we visited the Wicked Women Reboot Photography Exhibition, and we interviewed a number of people about their experience with that particular sex-positive, women-focused, but also trans and gender-diverse inclusive-focused exhibition of photographs that essentially copied the photographs from a 1990s publication called Wicked Women and reproduce those by way of having today's community get in front of a camera, in a professional photographer, and repose those very same poses. I spoke with Clem and Cody about this exhibition, and they had some really interesting thoughts to give around that that I thought could also just be shared more generally, because the event itself was on the 5th of April, so it's not something we can attend now. But on the other hand, I think that the what they have to say around queer culture, including what it holds for queer cultural futures, sort of fits in with the theme of today's program.
I'm Clem. I use he, they pronouns.
Cody, he, him pronouns.
Cool. And he, him pronouns.
Yes.
You're cisgendered.
No.
No. No. You're
trans man.
Trans man.
Yes.
You are a very passable trans man.
Thank you.
Bloody trans man.
tell you what, they take their tea, you know, and it all happens for them, doesn't it?
8 years.
For God's sake.
8 years. Oh. That's it.
I'm always, you know, particularly with the body hair. Like the amount of bloody pain I've been through, laser and crap to get off the friggin' blank hairs. And most of them are grey now, so they don't come off right. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you buggers, you know, you get tea, and you get everything you want.
Yep, yeah, yeah.
It's a disgrace.
I claim it.
Well, good for
proud
you.
Of that.
Good
thank
for
you.
You.
Thank you.
All right, lovely. So, I dare say this is one of the key, you know, milestones for, you know, queer women in Melbourne at the moment.
Yep.
What I particularly like about it is it's a congregation. There's so many people involved. Mm. There's the people who are curating. There's the models, you know, and then the participants themselves, I think, become part of the event. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I mean...
Stop pointing at each other and answer the question.
I think me and Cody have known Tiger for... actually like a year or so. We got to know Tiger because we both worked on a project that used the archives. And yes, we got to know Tiger, and then also as trans men, we got to know Jasper's history as well, especially Jasper starting Wicked Women with Tiger and also being like one of the first openly trans men, I think, in Australia essentially. Yeah, I just think it's such a huge moment, especially so many of the photos have been recontextualized with some trans men or people who identify on the masculine spectrum. I think it's just, I mean, it shows like we're here, we're in this community, and to see that reflected back has been really meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I mean, you know, I mean, every time I talk with someone, there's some integration,
yeah,
you know, that they're involved in with this, it's a truly communal project.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so thanks for that background.
Yeah.
Yeah, how about yourself? Any reflections on the sort of, I think, you know, almost the hyper-communal nature of this event?
Yeah, I mean, we were here for the talk before, and I think different ways of engaging with the subject as well. So inversion of the talk, the opening, knowing people who have been there throughout the entire creative process.
Yes.
You know, and then reflecting on the actual artifact itself and sort of going back in time and I guess layering these different ways of viewing the same, I guess, subject matter or material. As a participant in multiple ways, a participant as a reader, a participant as a viewer, a participant as a listener, is something that I feel enables you to interact with the work on a deeper level, which I like, if that's the question. I don't know, I forgot the question, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, you have answered the question. Yeah. I just give people this look, because you might have noticed it makes people feel like they need to say more. And the more they say, the more better. I can broadcast. Mm. So it does work, doesn't it?
Yeah,
sort
yeah.
of look, is it?
Yeah.
So what really strikes me, again, about this is the history. Hmm. Right, this, and it's reflecting history in a contemporary way. And what I just find it so powerful that they do that by, it seems to be a really powerful way to do it. I'm now starting to talk like Molly Meldrum, you know, rambling but still have a point. Showing my age when I mention Molly Meldrum too. But basically, there are the original photos, and then there is the new photos. And there seems to be something unspoken, both obvious yet unspoken, about how they tie together. What it says about, you know, the culture then and the culture now. Both in terms of a reflection on the change and a reflection on the culture now as it is. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think looking at the recreations of the original photographs, it almost as if I feel like the original photographs are living again, and that's this sort of, I guess, break this linear way of thinking in terms of our old histories and our contemporary histories at the moment, because
stop being artifacts.
Yeah, they live. Yeah, they're living again in the way that we're bringing them back to life, and you know, even if they were, you know, recreated within the same week instead of being decades apart, it's almost as if the two talk to each other, because they're both very much alive to each other and talking to each other, and the work that was done previously is just as alive as the contemporary work. And I feel like those you know, reimaginings of those photos just in a way are like a threshold to bring these old photographs into now, and they're just as relevant now, and it's almost as if
the two kind of merge in a way, because we...
Yes, so this has been Queering the Air, broadcast on 3CR Radical Radio on 855 on your AM radio dial, and digitally streamed on 3cr.org.au/streaming. And next up will be the Salaam Radio Show. And just to take us out for a few minutes, so a bit of Queer Nation, which is a track, 2021 deep house track from a group called the House of Pride, that features the vocals of 70s soul diva Lolita Holloway. As this is the podcast version, this music is not part of the recording.